Welcome to the podcast, the conversation of Maria Rybakova with Dr. Maya Savevska. This project is part of a grant funded by the European Union. Views and opinions expressed are, however, those of the author only and do not necessarily reflect those of the European Union or the European Education and Culture Executive Agency, EACEA. Neither the European Union nor EACEA can be held responsible for them. Dr. Maya Savevska is Assistant Professor in International Political Economy at the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at Nazarbayev University. She joined the Department of Political Science and International Relations in the fall of 2016. She completed Erasmus Mundus joint doctorate in Globalization, Europe and Multilateralism at the University of Warwick and the Université Libre de Bruxelles. Her PhD mobility program was fully funded by the European Commission. Her previous appointments include a residential fellowship at the Institute for Global Law and Policy at Harvard Law School, following her successful completion of her PhD. Broadly defined, Dr. Savevska's research interests lie at the intersection of international political economy, IPE, and European Union studies. Welcome, Maya. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us today. And I would like to start with these two questions. I would like to ask you, what are the core actors of the EU foreign security policy and where do you think it is all going?
Good afternoon, Maria. Thank you for inviting me to be part of your podcast. And I hope that as a former Jean Monnet professor at Nazarbayev University, I can answer some of your questions. Even though my expertise lies within the political economy domain, I'm more than happy to talk about foreign policy of the European Union, broadly speaking, broadly defined, yeah? And I would like to share, I have created slides for us so that maybe it will be more of a guided discussion.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Let me know if you can actually see the slides.
I can. Yes.
You can.
Yes.
Yeah, they're visible. Okay. So again, thank you for welcoming me here in your podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the core actors, the institutional features, and some of the content, substantive content of the EU foreign and security policy. And this is the agenda. So I'm going to start with talking about the global context that is actually the driver behind the development of this foreign and security policy. And we're going to talk about the historical evolution a little bit of where, how we got this policy area to be at an EU level at all, and what are the features of this policy area vis-a-vis maybe other policy areas in the EU. And then we're going to just skim the surface of evaluating some of the success stories or failures of this policy.
Fantastic.
Okay. So let's start with geopolitical context. And before we address important points about the foreign policy and how it is the biggest challenge to EU federalist ambition, let's start with examining the context. So we are we're facing new geopolitical risks and they often act as drivers at defining what EU foreign policies, right? Foreign policy is always a response to external events. And currently what we are facing is a very interesting geopolitical situation where we have revisionist Russia. I would probably single out as the biggest immediate threat to European security. So we have the occupation in Ukraine, but also revisionist Russia that has moved kind of tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus for the first time last year. And has ramped up the nuclear rhetoric that is really scary. So we have that in the backyard of Europe and in Europe. Then we have the increasingly bullish China, so assertive China that tends to supply Russia with dual-use technologies and moreover it has engaged in incremental and steady expansion of its nuclear capacities. So this turns China into suddenly a strategic competitor and rival rather than beforehand a core partner, a neutral partner, as was defined by EU strategy. So we see redefinition of the EU policy towards China lately, even though there is a less consensus on this, how we deal with China in the EU policy than how we deal with Russia. So the unity around Russia was fascinating, but we don't see it in the case of China. And I'm going to talk about it later a little bit. Then we have the overall in the international system, what we are seeing is disintegration of the nuclear arms control regime. So this international regime that we have created during the Cold War that has enabled us to not only control, but to reduce the stockpile of nuclear weapons is over. Okay, so because of many reasons, but this is the reality that EU is facing. So the questions of what kind of nuclear deterrence program we're going to have going to be on the agenda in the future. And of course, there is conflict in the Middle East with Israel-Iran full-scale war, potential war. We don't know what would happen there. There has been quite a lot of coup d'etats in the Sahel region. There are a lot of maritime threats in the Red Sea and various other sea. And of course, there is the second Trump presidency that is scary because we know how Trump behaved during the first presidency. He withdrew from a lot of international agreements. He acted unilaterally in a multilateral system, and maybe second Trump presidency would be even more assertive. And we don't know whether US under Trump would remain a credible guarantor of European security, which has been since the end of the Second World War, right, under NATO. So we don't know whether US would fulfill its NATO commitments. Trump has been very ambiguous on this. And there are also various cybersecurity attacks, and we're seeing lately Russian cyber attacks on European railway networks. So we are facing a lot of threats. So this is the geopolitical risk that we are facing. I would single out that in this geopolitical context, there are some, in international relations, there are some power transition theories that have been warning us that when there is a changes in the distribution of power, these changes to the status quo would not be necessarily smooth or peaceful. And we indeed see from the 90s to today, there is a changes in the distribution of power. So if EU, US, Japan were controlling a bigger share of world output, today they're having smaller share, and there is rising China. China is the single country that has actually increased its economic power. So it's the second largest economy nowadays. First by purchasing power parity, actually, if you look at it. So depending which measure you take. So you have changes in this in the distribution of power. And the question remains, what would that mean for the security internationally? Okay. What would rising China be like? Would it be very assertive? Would it be aggressive? Would it like to recreate the rules of the multilateral system that we have created, rule-based trade system investment or not? So this rise of power actually translates into, or the increasing economic capacity of China translates often in increasing its military capacity. So we see the military expenditure of China has increased over time. There is a question always among realists in international relations, the debate whether there is economic interdependence, whether this would be enough to mitigate against the risk of rising China. And would it be able to prevent war? So there's disagreement between offensive realists who think that wealthy China would not be happy with the status quo and would be very assertive. And there is those that are less scared, defensive realists who talk that China is in a crowded neighborhood. And it is indeed in a crowded neighborhood. Today, China accounts for 17% of global GDP. Yeah, like it's 13 trillion GDP. And back in the days, in the at the end of the Second World War, U.S. accounted for 50% of global GDP. So U.S. was really a superpower that was overshadowing everybody else, was dwarfing everybody else. We don't have such a situation today. So we do have many other actors that actually account for other share of GDP. But this is the reality when we look at the nuclear arms control regime today. We see it is very disintegrated in a sense that there is a collapse of major international treaties. that were the pillars of providing international security, a major public good internet globally. Nowadays, we don't know what would happen to the nuclear forces globally, whether there would be a major shift. We see that China has increased its nuclear capacity. Maybe Iran would join this club of nine nations that are nuclear powers. But within this context of maybe US under Trump presidency, this changes a lot of the game dynamics for Europe and the calculations, because who would provide nuclear deterrence on our behalf? Yeah, would still be US willing to sacrifice New York for Paris? And then we have many other questions arising out of it. So this is in nutshell the geopolitical context that we are facing. And because of this geopolitical context, we are actually seeing, I would argue, a definition of a new EU grand strategy, or for the first time, the creation of a grand strategy this crisis or risk that we're facing act as exogenous forces that push EU into developing more coherent foreign and security policy. And often in EU studies, we see the crisis narrative as present, that in a sense that we see that crisis is generator of further integration in the EU. We're facing a given crisis, can be security, can be economic crisis, and we see further integration. You know, we are facing crisis in the exchange rate regimes, we're seeing monetary integration. We're seeing Eurozone competitiveness crisis, we are seeing integration in other domains, banking union development. So we're seeing that a lot, even though this is contested as a narrative. Some scholars argue that crises are not drivers of integration, on the contrary. But often in the case of foreign and security policy has been the reason for emergence of a new ambition at the EU level, the ambition to become a full-scale foreign and security actor. So EU traditionally has defined itself as a self-consciously has perception of itself as civilian power, a normative power that engages in peaceful diplomacy, and it's interested in using economic instruments. You know, we are trade integration, we are various instruments. It wants to establish a rule-based system internationally, an idea that we have to credit the US with, not the EU. But EU wants to further it. And so we had this development of civilian power for most of EU existence. And then we have new reality in the 90s that pushed the EU to become a strategic actor. Okay, and strategic actor means that you have to engage in some dirty work. Okay, so you have to become not just an economic superpower. So the EU is indeed the second or third largest economy, depending which indicators you take, and it's really big economic powerhouse. But why does it pull below its waist when it comes to military and security issues? So we see now with the president of the European Commission, von der Leyen talks about the commission becoming a geopolitical commission for the first time. We see High Representative Joseph Borrell talking about the need to EU to learn the language of power. So we have a development of, for the first time, of European defense industrial strategies that attempts to actually create the framework for creating the first military industrial complex in the EU. So there is some discursive shift, but also material shift in the EU. We're shifting away from just we're trying to bring you human rights norms to your jurisdiction, to we're actually gonna be outsourcing even asylum processing centers to your jurisdiction. So quite a lot of changes in the rhetoric, but also in the actions of the EU. And where does this start? Actually, so this ambition to develop a foreign security policy. Actually, we have early predecessors. Believe it or not, in the 50s, we had first attempt to create a truly European defense community, a supranational community that would pool control and defense resources at the EU level. And that was kind of championed by French bureaucrats, but it failed to be ratified by the French Assembly. So it's sad enough that it died in France. And then we had this European political cooperation in the 70s. In the late 60s, Charles de Gaulle insisted on creating an intergovernmental cooperation in security outside of the European Economic Community. So we wanted to insulate the supranational governance institutions of the EU from this domain to put in charge as member states. So we see bastion of national sovereignties, the foreign policy. But So there were contentions back in the days among groups of countries who actually preferred to, and they favored cooperation of security to be under the auspices of NATO. So we call them the Atlanticists, and those who favor the development of autonomous European capacity, full capacity. So there has been contentions since then, and these contentions continues today. But new reality pushed EU to actually develop the first, to make the first step toward developing a coherent foreign policy. And that was the first done in the early 90s with the Treaty of Maastricht, where we created the first common foreign security policy, and the pillar structure was very minimal, first steps, very intergovernmental. That the Treaty of Amsterdam amended because there was war in Yugoslavia, and that really created impetus for further institutionalizing this policy. So we created High Representative Office in charge of foreign policy. Think of that office as a foreign affairs minister of the EU, like the State Department of the EU. Then there is the Nice Treaty that created even a security and defense policy as part of the common foreign and security policy. And the Lisbon Treaty created the biggest reform, abolishes the pillar structure between the foreign and security policy and justice and home affairs on one hand, and the rest of the economic cooperation. So we have reform of the High Representative Office that is very substantial. So quite a lot of actions have been done. And we're today at what stage of this policy? So today we have a situation where the feature of this policy that we have created is still very intergovernmental. Okay, it's intergovernmental in character. Now, what do we mean by that? We mean that member states are in charge of it, making decisions in this policy area. And this is not the case with many other EU policy areas. So you have monetary policy, it's exclusive EU competence, and the ECB is in charge of that. You have competition policy, European Commission is in charge of that. You have trade policy, so-called external trade, commercial relations, the Commission is in charge of that. So you have a lot of policy area where that are exclusive competences. That means that the EU is exclusively acting to legislate on these matters, to regulate these matters. They're competences that are shared between member states and the EU, and their competences like foreign policy that is unique, that is still very intergovernmental. Here, the European Council and the Council of Ministers are core decision makers. So they decide on what's going to happen, like, let's say, the decision to have what kind of sanction regimes against Russia and maybe Iran now, lately, the discussions. So we have, that is the decision-making body. The High Representative as an office is very important, created with Treaty of Amsterdam, but Lisbon really created a different structure where the High Representative chairs the Foreign Affairs Council. So this is Council of Minister configuration that was created. It chairs the European External Action Service. Sorry, this is misspelling. And the European Defense Agency. So we have this new office that is very powerful. We have a very limited role for the Court of Justice. So Court of Justice has no jurisdiction on output from this policy area. Court of Justice can adjudicate on many other policy areas, but not on this one, except to review the legality of sanctions. And we saw that it overturned a few days ago some sanctions against Russian oligarchs, and also to police the boundary between this policy and other policy area. But though I have to qualify this statement here, because in recent case law by the Court of Justice, we see that it's expanding voluntarily its jurisdictional reach in foreign security matters, actually. And I'm going to let legal scholars debate it, but it's expanding its jurisdiction. This is classical Court of Justice story. They have expanded its jurisdiction in many other areas. So this is expected, you know. And the European Commission is sidelined, even though lately more involved with the industrial strategy. The European Parliament role is really consultative, so it's nothing. And the anonymity is a key mode of decision making, which creates a lot of veto players, so difficult to make decisions. But in other words, the institutionalization of this policy at the EU level has led to increasing what we call Brusselization of this policy. So many decisions are made in Brussels, but not to the supranationalization or communitarization of this policy. So we don't have a creation of a supranational body that makes decisions in this policy. Member states remain the key decision maker in this policy. Now, to outsiders who are still want to get a phone call one phone number that they can call when it comes to EU foreign policies. We're not there yet. Okay, so this is in reference to Kissinger famous saying that he wishes there is a single phone number he can call somebody in Europe when he needs to decide on a common response. We still don't have it because we have the president of the European Council, the president of the European Commission, and now the high representative. And each one of them has different external representation in different areas, right? So it's kind of when the search for common international interlocutor won't be smooth, but that doesn't mean that the EU is not a true actor in this domain. It is a true actor that has an agency to put forward a lot of output in this domain. And this output has come in the form of a couple of strategies. So from the creation of the High Representative Office, we have the first strategy of Solana in 2023. He was the first High Representative. And very interesting geopolitical awakening happens under him, but not truly. He's still seeing Europe as a normative power, right? We are not talking about regular power. We are talking about bringing human rights everywhere. Mogherini actually has Europe global strategy, and that is for the first time articulation of a new policy goal and development of a strategic autonomy of the EU. So Europe should be ready to provide security more alone, okay? It's a major public good to citizens, and we should be ready to provide it. The commitment is to peace and security internationally. There is commitment to maintaining the rule-based international system, but we also have to be ready to deter threats, okay? That entails being proactive. And Borrell's latest strategic compass strategy goes even further. So we're talking about, at least on an ambition level, attempts to become a true strategic actor that can engage militarily, if need be, and put the money where the words are, where the mouth is, because we want to invest in defense spending. We don't want to be just having this rhetorical articulations of the EU foreign and security policy. We want to match that with resources being spent. Now, if we are to evaluate now at the very end the common foreign and security policy, we have to ask the first question would be, how successful is the EU at, or this policy at, forging EU-wide consensus? Because we know that member states are core decision makers. Anonymity is the decision-making role. So how do we build consensus, okay? How do we create a common, united European foreign policy? There are a lot of vetoes that delay actions, actually. So because of the rule of anonymity. And if we had to do a proper exercise overview of how successful the EU is, we will see that, well, sometimes these vetoes are hard, you know, and we saw that with Viktor Orban being the core troublemaker that is vetoing any action that we want to have against China or Russia. It's has been doing that, but sometimes even small powers can veto and delay action. So an interesting case was the Belarusian problem, when we wanted to impose sanctions on Lukashenko regime for violently cracking on protests and rigging the election in Belarus. It is Cyprus that vetoed the EU initial response because they wanted similar sanctions for Turkey, not that they were against this. So sometimes you can use your power of veto to draw attention to some other issue area. So the power of veto is yielded occasionally by even small states. And it can be a problem. And in the long run, we're going to reach consensus. So we eventually have sanctions against Belarus, but there would be delay in our action. And in foreign policy, it's really important that we are more effective at making rapid decisions. Then there is the question of divergent national preference. And for me, this is the most difficult one, because I believe that consensus has been successfully forged over many issue area, but the divergent national preferences remain. And we see that on the notion of China policy. So Germany, now Olaf Scholz is in China with his own German delegation. So Germany has its own foreign policy toward China, and that is not necessarily aligned always with the EU. And the EU is just forming its foreign policy towards China, and it's shifting its focus of looking at it as a strategic competitor that we have to seriously create a framework where we're going to be able to even protect ourselves. So in trade policy, we have this like anti-coercive mechanism following China retaliation against Lithuanian introduction of a representative office of Taiwan in its jurisdiction. So sometimes, there are divergent national preferences, yeah? And sometimes states act out of its own will. So they have their own foreign policy. So Lithuania allowed Taiwan to open a representative office in its jurisdiction, and that created uproar in China and escalation, trade escalation. And what can we do? You know, it's a sovereign state, Lithuania can do that. So we do have a lot of divergent national preferences around the foreign policy itself, in a sense that some want to see truly supranational policy with EU command and EU resources allocated to it. And some want to see still NATO as being the core provider of security. We have a lot of divergence around these views too. And so there is problem when it comes to pooling of resources. And this is really important because a few days ago, Alexander Stubb, the Finnish president, gave an interview and he talks about the need to have pooling of sovereignty in procurement of defense and pooling of sovereignty in planning and operations. But when it comes to pooling of sovereignty for financing this, we don't have a consensus, right? We don't want to have EU-wide debt instruments, issuance of euro bonds, euro defense bonds to help us finance this. We don't have that. So there is asymmetry actually in the policy objective and actually the military capacity and the financing capacity behind this foreign policy. So in the US, there is no asymmetry. You have US foreign grant strategy, and then you have the full mighty power of the fiscal of the federal states to back that action. Here, not really. We really depend on member states. So our financial instruments in this policy area are weak, and they need to be strengthened. And I want to draw the attention to the support for Ukraine, which is very interesting. EU institutions are the biggest donor, which is great, but we see a huge disparity of spending between member states. So according to the EU foreign security policy, supporting Ukraine is a core objective, but member states are slacking, you know, because they are the one at the end who needs to spend money. And we see huge discrepancy between spending in Germany, France. I see here, if you look at the total bilateral aid given to Ukraine as a share of GDP, you see that the support for the EU foreign security policy policy towards Ukraine, it's supposed to be given by every member state, but you see that many states are, it's at the level of rhetoric. So we see France, Spain, Italy, Ireland, not doing great, actually, on spending. So only the Nordic states, the Baltics, Poland, and Germany, and, well, UK is outside of the EU now, are actually doing much, and not significant, you know, less than 0.7% of the GDP. So we see we need to make sure that policy objectives adopted at the EU level are matched by fiscal spending at a domestic level. But having said that, there are a lot of success stories, okay? So I do think that there are a lot of success stories when the EU has acted united, and that was the sanction regimes against Russia, right? We have 13 package of the sanctions against a Russian invasion of Ukraine, and we want to see more of this united response by member states on many other issues, not just Russia, because that's one of many security threats that we are facing. In the meantime, we also cannot ignore, irrespective of the fact whether we successfully deal with one security issue or another, that we have actually seen institutionalization of security policy, foreign and security policy, and we see that in the context of creation of a lot of agencies. So we have now the European External Action Service, which is led by the High Representative, and it's in charge of managing the EU foreign policy relations with the rest of the world. So they're having, think of it as a national foreign service. They have 140 missions abroad, you know. They have a lot of staff that they that is supposed to push forward globally the EU foreign policy objectives, right? There is also a very interesting development here, the Coordinated Annual Review of Defense. CARD is very interesting because it's kind of tries to, I'm a constructivist in conviction, and I believe that this exercise of ranking and surveilling of member states' defense practices, spending, budgets, its policy would lead to a convergence of best practice model. So it can be successful. We have coordination as a policy mode in many other policy areas that is successful, from employment, social, economic, well, more or less. But can we use the same method of coordination to further convergence towards common minimal standards in defense policy, of national defense policy, because member states still maintain their national defense policies? There is development of a European Defense Fund, and this is insignificant. It's only 8 billion euros for the fiscal multi-annual fiscal framework of from 21 to 27. That's not a lot. Allocation of resources to collaborative defense research, collaborative capacity development in defense area. So it's a politically significant that for the first time we see EU money being spent on something in this area. So I want to see it increase in size. And eventually, we maybe want to see mutualization of some debt obligation in this area. That would truly create a European defense policy. And there is the latest development. A few weeks ago, the European Commission announced the European Defense Industry Strategy that is supposed to help us develop the military capacity in the EU. We will see where that would end, but there's a lot of activities. So we see a lot of activities. So I see it as is becoming increasingly a global player. And indeed, we can debate the success of the various missions. We have a lot of missions and operations. Around totally, I think there 40 were actually initiated. But from the very first operation that was actually initiated in my own country, North Macedonia, in 2003, Concordia and Proxima missions, we have quite a lot of missions ongoing, military and civilian missions, and we can evaluate whether they're successful at realizing the EU foreign policy objective or not, and that's up for discussion. You know, we can create a criteria how we're going to evaluate it, and we can see if they yield any results. But the reality is that we see a lot of actions that we didn't have before. So, and I believe that it's true that we see a transition from a civilian power to more strategic actor. And in the future, probably we would be seeing more geopolitical commission. And with the new election, von der Leyen probably would get the second term, a second mandate to be president of the European Commission. We will see a furthering of the geopolitical stance of the common foreign security policy.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Maja Seweska. Thank you so much for this very clear, very fascinating talk. I have a small question. You cited the unanimity of the member states on the policy of imposing sanctions on Russia. Do you think it was a successful tool on putting pressure on Russia?
Maria, thank you for that wonderful question. Yes, indeed, I can go back to the slide before where we see the divergence in support for Ukraine among EU member states, right? So we have, at a level of rhetoric, a full commitment to supporting the Ukrainian fight for defending their territory and national integrity and territorial integrity and national sovereignty. But we see often, like, which is very common, the case of mismatch between rhetoric and action in foreign policy. And there might be many reasons for this divergence of support for Ukraine among EU member states, okay? So we have, for historical reason and geopolitical reasons, we have the Baltic states plus Poland, the Nordic states and Finland giving quite a lot of support to Ukraine, because they see the invasion of Ukraine as a core threat for their own national security. So defending the integrity of Ukraine, it's of great importance to them. And maybe there is a sense of insulation from these problems in more when we look at the Atlantic side. If you look at Portugal and Ireland, the level of support is not matched, or in Southern Europe, like Italy and Greece, we don't see that high level of support. We might also see other, we might even have like some, sometimes economic reasons can be there for why some not so wealthy nation cannot give as much support. But we can see that Bulgaria is not so wealthy, but it's quite supportive. So it is, it explains up to a level, right? It is really surprising why France, which is a wealthy nation, so it can pull its weight actually on this issue a little bit more. And it, France has been especially a kind of accused by German officials for the lack of aid given to Ukraine. And some French officials are disputing this, of course. Macron is saying that the statistics are not really accurate. But even if we take their statistics, the level of support would be still negligible. France is a country who actually likes to run a current account deficit. It hasn't put its fiscal house in order for a long time, and it does spend a lot. It's actually one of the few EU member states that spends on military operations elsewhere. So I don't think that the economic reasons are justifications enough for why France is not spending much. So we might also have in some countries political considerations. So there might be not a national consensus about the support in Ukraine, right? So we see the case of Hungary, not very supportive. And there we have a strong right-wing government that is aligned with Russia and China. So we don't see a lot of support there. So quite a lot of explanations can be given, but it's expected. We might have an EU policy on a matter, but at the end of the day is how much fiscal power we give to this policy, right? So the point of a foreign policy is that we make a decision on what is a strategic interest for a state. Let's say US make in its grand strategy, it identifies some priorities, and then it puts all its fiscal firepower to make to realize that foreign policy. And in the EU, we see that that's kind of hard. That member states would continue to have their own national priorities. Yeah. So for Italy, maybe the migration crisis is a priority. So they want to spend on defending their borders through investing in maritime security. So different countries have different national priorities of what is the core security threat. And there might not necessarily be alignment between the Baltic states and Portugal on what that is. So that's why there are a lot of legitimate questions that can be asked about the notion that we can have. Can we have an EU deterrent, actually, strategy, nuclear deterrent strategy? A lot of implications can arise out of this question. Like, yeah. So a lot of I don't want to take a lot more time than we have, but a lot of interesting things can be unpacked from just this one example. But there are many more examples when we see national divergence between action, actually, and preferences for foreign policy choices that countries make, and then in turn, the EU.
Thank you so much, dear Maya. I think that was very illuminating, very clear, and it was a pleasure having you on the podcast. Dr. Maya Savevska, Nazarbayev University. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, always pleasure to chat on EU-related matters.